A Unitarian Universalist pulled up at an intersection behind a car with a bumper sticker that read, "Honk if you love Jesus." And the Unitarian Universalist sat there, the red light behind the car, and he thought about this and decided, what the heck, he loved Jesus in his own way. So he gave the horn of his car a couple of love taps. The driver in the car in front of him stuck his head out of the window and shouted, "Quiet down, you jerk. Can't you see the light's still red?" Loving Jesus is not easy. I confess that I pretty much ignored Jesus for the first 23 years of my life, being raised in the Unitarian Universalist Congregation in Phoenix. But then I decided I wanted to go to graduate school to study to be a Unitarian Universalist minister. I wanted to do this not because of Jesus or the Bible, but because in the late 60s and the early 1970s, I had seen ministers of various denominations do very important work in the area of social action, opposing the Vietnam War, supporting the civil rights movement, and I wanted in some small way to be part of that. Now, it first dawned on me that I might need to learn about the Bible and Jesus when I went to see my Unitarian Universalist minister in Phoenix, the man who served my church, my first model of ministry, Ray Manker. And we sat in his office, and I said, "I've decided I want to be a minister," and we talked about which school I should go to and so forth. And then he said, "Roger, you're going to be lucky in seminary because the seminaries no longer require that every student study ancient Hebrew, classical Greek, and Aramaic." Well, when he said this, I got anxious because I had no idea what Aramaic was. I entered Star King School for the Ministry, a Unitarian Universalist school in Berkeley. It is still a part of a consortium called the Graduate Theological Union, which consists of 9 theological seminaries of various denominations, all of them together, working together to educate people about religion. I was free because I was in the Unitarian school, and they had very open policies about this. I was free to take classes in any of the 9 schools. So to learn about Jesus, I signed up for a class at the Jesuit School of Theology. The teacher was a woman scholar from the Middle East. She'd grown up, I believe, in Lebanon. She had a PhD in New Testament studies, and she had studied classical Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic. She's a great teacher, and she said at the beginning of the class, "Think about what we're doing as though we were entering into a detective story. A man was killed 2,000 years ago. Almost all the clues we know about him, all the information, is contained in 3 small books called Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So we're going to look at these 3 accounts and try to discover who this man was and why he was killed." She taught us the word synoptic. Synoptic is derived from a Greek word meaning together and a Greek word meaning view, viewing together. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptic gospels because together they present a similar view of Jesus. She said the 4th gospel, John's gospel, was written much later, and it tells almost a completely different story about Jesus from Matthew, Mark, and Luke. She said that the New Testament scholars believe that almost nothing in the Gospel of John can be traced back to the historic, real Jesus. So in the class, we were just going to focus on those 3 Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We were asking, where did these 3 manuscripts come from? Who wrote them? When were they written? Now, of course, none of the Gospels has a copyright date, but scholars believe that someone wrote the Gospel of Mark in about the year 70, about 40 years after the death of Jesus on the cross. And then, of course, I ask, why did 40 years pass before someone wrote down an account of Jesus' life? My teacher said, the guess is that in the 40 years after the death of Jesus, the first Christians believed that Jesus would soon return to earth. Therefore, because he was going to come back at any moment, it was not necessary to write anything down. But the siege of Jerusalem changed this perspective. In the year 70 AD, it was a decisive event in the first Jewish-Roman war. The Roman army conquered the city. The siege ended with the destruction of the second temple. The Western Wall, or the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem today, was originally part of the second Jewish temple. Scholars guess that someone wrote Mark's gospel around the time of the destruction of the temple, because the author realized that Jesus might not be returning as soon as they thought, and that those who knew the story, they were dying out. Therefore, it was important to put down the story of Jesus' ministry in writing. I learned that Jesus had spoken a language called Aramaic. And the Aramaic Jesus spoke, I was taught, is still spoken in one place on earth, a small village 60 kilometers northeast of Damascus. Well, today, the civil war in Syria has put this Aramaic-speaking village in danger. Because of the war, this once picturesque village, a village that was a tourist attraction for Christian pilgrims, today it's now full of charred homes and bombarded churches and monasteries. Many of the Christians who spoke Aramaic who lived there have gone into exile in Lebanon, and we have no way of knowing whether the village will survive this terrible civil war. Although Jesus spoke Aramaic, all the Gospels are written in Greek. Mark was written in the year 70, about then. Matthew and Luke was written sometime between 80 and 90 years after Jesus was born. But no manuscripts date back to those years. No, there's no document written in 70 or 80 or 90. The oldest gospel fragment still in existence is from John's gospel. When I visited Manchester, England a few years ago, I went to the John Rylands Library to see this fragment. It's a small piece of papyrus with Greek writing on both sides, dated to the year 125. I was in the library and looking at this in the display case, and while I was there, there was no one else in the room. For a few minutes, I was alone with the oldest fragment in existence of any New Testament. Well, today there are two complete texts of the New Testament in existence. The Vatican owns one that was written about 325 years after the birth of Jesus, around the time of the Council of Nicaea. The second complete text was discovered about 150 years ago by a German researcher. In 1844, he visited St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai. He was looking for manuscripts, looking for old Bibles. He was browsing around the library, and he saw a basket full of parts of old manuscripts containing fragments of the Old Testament in Greek. They were in a basket whose contents, according to the librarian, had already, the librarian would gather things that he didn't think were very useful and put in the basket, and they were used as fuel for the monastery stove. They'd already done this twice before. This was a third basket, waiting to be burned, this kindling. The researcher said, could I have permission to take these pages to my room and look at them. The librarian said he might as well have them because they were about to be burned anyway. Later, when the librarian saw how excited this German visitor became looking at these pages, he refused to show him the source from which he had taken the manuscripts. Well, this was a persistent German researcher, so he returned to Mount Sinai and to St. Catherine's Monastery in 1853. But the same librarian refused him access to the source of these pages. Well, the librarian wouldn't allow him to see it, but the German researcher was persistent. In 1859, he returned again, and at first he had the same experience. He found nothing remarkable that he was allowed to see. But one day he was walking around the monastery garden with one of the residents, one of the priests, and they were discussing ancient texts of the Greek Bible. When they returned to the monastery, the man invited the visiting researcher from Germany into his room for refreshments. And then from a corner, he took an object wrapped in cloth, which he placed before the researcher on the table. The researcher unwrapped the cloth, and before him lay the oldest complete copy of the Bible in existence. The whole New Testament was there. He received permission to take the book back to his room. He was so excited he couldn't sleep. By the light of a small lamp, he spent that night reading the oldest manuscript about the life of Jesus. Well, eventually, Tsar Alexander II paid the monastery about $7,000 in American money for the manuscript, and it went to Russia. In the 1930s, when the Soviet government was in need of money and not interested in biblical manuscripts, the British government was able to purchase the Old and the New Testament manuscript for $500,000. In a trip to London, I have seen this ancient New Testament in a glass case in the British Library. It's written on calfskin. Scribes created this manuscript sometime around 325. Scholars consider the text in the British Library and the text in the Vatican to be the two best texts of the New Testament. What this means for the study of Jesus is that the accounts of the life of this Aramaic-speaking Jesus were written down in Greek between the year 70 and the year 90. Then scribes copied and recopied these Greek accounts by hand for 250 years before a scribe created a book that has not turned to dust. And then, of course, I read them in English translations. This is my only source of information about the life of Jesus. These Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they're virtually all we have to go on. To make this even more confusing, the words in the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, and Luke were altered by the people who copied the manuscripts. Scholars have compared the text of the British Library version to the text of the Vatican Library version, both created around the same time, and they found over 3,000 differences in the Gospels in the two manuscripts. Modern scholars have tried to determine which passages are likely to be original. They have concluded that there is little we can say with confidence about the life of Jesus. But there are a few things we can say. They are fairly certain that John the Baptist baptized Jesus at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and that Jesus' ministry was in some way linked with that of John the Baptist. The scholars are fairly confident that Jesus proclaimed the coming of the kingdom of God which is also translated as the coming of God's imperial rule or the coming of God's domain. Now, what Jesus meant by this proclamation is in dispute. Some believe that this was a political statement about ridding the country of the Roman conquerors and the corrupt temple priests and replacing them with a just and fair society. The scholars are fairly confident that Jesus had a reputation as a healer. People believed he was able to help others who were suffering from illnesses. For there are many stories about this in the Gospels. I like the spit miracles where he spits on his fingers and touches someone's ears. He has to actually do this twice. It doesn't work the first time. And the scholars think, well, they wouldn't, if this wasn't true, if they were making it up, he would have been successful the first time. So this is probably authentic. Jesus brought together, the scholars say, a group of men and women with little concern about their previous background, about their tribal identifications or their economic situation. A central feature of the life of this group that Jesus gathered together was eating together, sharing a meal. Jesus told stories. He spoke in parables. And he called God by the Aramaic word for Father, Abba. Jesus challenged the tendency of the Jewish community of his day to fragment itself and to reject certain of its members. And this, they suggest, is what really arose the opposition to him, which reached a climax during the Passover celebration in Jerusalem when the Romans arrested him, tried him, and crucified him. Now, the scholars agree that Jesus did not claim to be God. One of them wrote, "It is a striking feature of modern historic research that there is general agreement that the Messiah and divinity claims put on the lips of Jesus of the Gospels are exactly that, claims put on the lips of Jesus by the scribes writing years after Jesus' death." As far as the New Testament scholars can tell, Jesus proclaimed the kingdom of God, but made no claims for himself. And of course, Unitarians argue that the gospel stories about Jesus prove that Jesus was a human being. They describe a human being who was happy, who was sorrowful, who was hungry and thirsty, who suffered and died. Well, that's basically what people believe about the historic Jesus, the best researchers. But there is another way to look at the Gospels. As I would with any story, I look at the writings of the New Testament in terms of my own experience, and especially in Christian holy days such as Easter, I ask myself, do these stories enrich my life? Do I learn from them? Do I benefit from them? Do the wisdom sayings offer useful advice in my own day-to-day living? Can the example of Jesus' life serve as a model for me? So when I'm finished with gathering the facts about the historic Jesus, in the end, the value of the Gospels depends on whether the words give meaning to my life. And for me, the answer is yes. When I read, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his own country," I learn about the difficulties of social action. When I read, "To him who strikes you on the cheek, offer the other also," I learn about the nature of nonviolence. When I read, Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who abuse you. I learn about the nature of radical love. When I read, "Where your treasure is, there will be your heart also," I learn about the danger of greed. When I read, "How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take that speck out of your eye,' when there's a log in your own eye?" I learn about the nature of counseling and giving advice. When I read, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves," I learn about the nature of evil within us, including the potential evil in certain politicians who are false prophets. So early in the spring at Easter, people all over the world gather to celebrate. And many gather at this time to express their affection for the teachings of Jesus. And some of them even display that affection by putting stickers on their cars. If I find myself at an intersection behind a car with a bumper sticker that reads, "Honk if you love Jesus," I may actually toot my horn, even at the risk of being yelled at. Because after all, in my own way, I love Jesus. Each year at Easter, I join in celebration of the fact that his stories, his wisdom sayings, have survived for 2,000 years and give guidance to millions of people all around the world.